From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Secret Life of an Animal. We talk with Eric Burden, the lead singer for the British invasion band, The Animals. The band produced hits like House of the Rising Sun and We Gotta Get Out of This Place. His new CD is called My Secret Life. Also, Curb Your Enthusiasm. The show just completed its fourth season. We play back a 1992 interview with star Larry David when he was still behind the scenes at Seinfeld. And we'll talk with Curb Your Enthusiasm executive producer, Bob Whitey. Later, linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the different speaking styles of 2004 presidential hopefuls John Kerry and George Bush. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorneys have filed papers in federal court on behalf of nine prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They're asking the federal government to explain why the men are being held or to let them go. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The move is a follow-up to this week's Supreme Court ruling saying the U.S. had to give the detainees access to attorneys. The Bush administration had argued the president has the power to hold the prisoners incommunicado, but the high court decided otherwise. Now attorneys for the Center for Constitutional Rights and other groups are trying to get access to the courts for some of the detainees. More filings are expected for the more than 600 prisoners held at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base since the war in Afghanistan. On Thursday, attorneys demanded that the Defense Department grant access to some of the detainees. Only a handful have been allowed to talk to lawyers. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The economy created 112,000 jobs in June, less than half of what most analysts had been predicting. The Bush administration says economic growth remains strong and on track. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The White House reacted to the disappointing jobs number by focusing instead on the positive, 10 straight months of job increases. The president also felt compelled to offer a reminder of events of the past 3.5 years.
After all, we've been through a recession, a national emergency, a war, corporate scandals. We've got an economy which is changing. It's the nature of the job base is changing. And all that means it's been a difficult period of time, yet we're strong, we're getting stronger.
The president said tax cuts he's pushed through Congress have made a difference. His critics, including Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry, say those cuts have overwhelmingly gone to the wealthiest Americans and that 10 months of job gains have not come close to offsetting the job losses under this president. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Actor Marlon Brando has died from lung failure at a Los Angeles hospital. He was 80. Brando is widely credited with changing the nature of acting to a style that was more natural. He won fame for his work in movies such as A Streetcar Named Desire. Brando's co-star in On the Waterfront, Eve Marie Saint, said that his concentration on the character was phenomenal.
Working with him was incredible. I think we really stayed in our characters all the time, even when we had lunch. And that was the way we worked, and I think he was always trying to figure me out as Edie, not Eva Marie, and I was trying to figure him out as Terry, not Marlon.
Both Brando and Saint won Academy Awards for their work in On the Waterfront. Brando won a second Oscar and revived a lagging career in 1972 with his portrayal of a mafia don in The Godfather. In stocks, the Dow lost 51 to close at 10,282. The Nasdaq was down 9 to 2006. This is NPR News. Three American soldiers have been charged with manslaughter in the drowning of an Iraqi man who was forced to jump off a bridge into the Tigris River. A fourth soldier faces assault charges for allegedly forcing a second Iraqi man to jump off the bridge. That man was able to swim to shore. Both Iraqis had been stopped for a curfew violation. The soldiers are now at Fort Carson in Colorado. A mysterious event this winter caused a massive loss of water from one of Saturn's rings. Cassini scientists wonder whether they witnessed a process that will gradually make the rings disappear entirely. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Pasadena.
From time to time, an instrument aboard Cassini looked at a vast invisible ring around Saturn, far outside the dazzling ones we see in pictures. Sometime in mid-January, this instrument picked up an event. In one area, water molecules were blasted to bits, leaving atoms of hydrogen and oxygen behind. These oxygen atoms then gradually disappeared, presumably out into deep space. That means this thin outer ring of Saturn probably just got a little bit thinner. Scientists say at this rate, the ring could disappear entirely in about 100 million years. This is one more indication that Saturn's icy rings are not permanent features around the 4-billion-year-old planet, but we just happen to be around at the right time to enjoy the show. Richard Harris, NPR News at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
The American Automobile Association predicts that more Americans will be on the roads this holiday weekend. AAA says travel will be up almost 3.5% over the 4th of July, with nearly 40 million Americans traveling at least 50 miles from home. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Eric Burdon was the lead singer of the English band The Animals, which was part of the British invasion of the mid-60s. Their hits included House of the Rising Sun, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, and We Gotta Get Out of This Place. After moving to the U.S., he formed a new version of The Animals, which had such counterculture-era hits as Sky Pilot and San Francisco Nights. Burdon was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995. He has a new CD now, My Secret Life. Let's hear The Animals' first hit, House of the Rising Sun. Terry spoke with Burdon in 2002. She asked him about the early days of the British invasion, when the Animals, the Beatles, and the Stones were getting off the ground.
I took one look at the Stones one night. I mean, I'd met Mick before. I'd jammed with him down in London, in Reading, which is not far from where they grew up, collectively, the Stones grew up. And I would travel to Paris to buy records and to London to buy records. And then I would stop off at Alex's Corner, God bless him, his club, where there was the first British R&B movement there. And the Stones and myself, you know, before we were Animals, before we were Stones, we all crowd into this room and listen to these guys interpreting American music. And it would just blow our socks off, you know. So we'd stand in line asking Mr. Corner, Alexis, please, can we sing, man? Can we jam with you, you know? And he'd say, yeah, okay, tonight, Mick, Eric, do you know Elmore James's, you know, Key to the Highway? Yeah, and we'd get up and we'd jump. Yeah, okay. Then we all went home and we thought about it. And we started our own bands and we became the Animals. And we didn't have any idea that down in London, the Rolling Stones become the Stones. What overnight grew from a brotherhood of musicians, worshiping black Americans, worshiping American culture, trying to spread the word to audiences by every night saying, look, we're going to play a tune now. It's called Roll Over Beethoven. But you can get this record at your local record store tomorrow by Chuck Berry. Please, buy the record by Chuck Berry. Don't listen, you know, take my advice. Don't listen to me. That was one of my favorite slogans at the time.
Let me play another recording that you made with the Animals, this one in 1965. It's We've Got to Get Out of This Place.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people
People tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due, I know. Watch my dad.
You grew up in Newcastle, which is a coal mining town.
Yeah.
Did you want to get out of there? Did this song express the sentiment of how you felt?
I wanted to get out of everything. we saw imported American movies and French movies, and at the local theater that would show anything that was X-rated, and we would make our way in there by hook or by crook, and we'd see these movies when we were supposed to be studying in at college, at art school. And it was like, we want to be there. We want to get there. The song became an anthem for different people. You know, everybody at somewhere in their life wants to get out of the situation they're in.
When you were growing up in Newcastle, did your father work in the mines?
No, he was lucky. He was an electrician. But he took me down a mine one day because he used to do the electrical servicing of the pits, the collieries. So when the pit was shut down and all of the miners were away on holiday, he took me down the shaft to the pit floor. And I stood there in the total freezing cold darkness, and it was damp, wet water dripping everywhere. And funny enough, it was called the Rising Sun Colliery. And I just knew that he did that to let me know just what it was like to be down there.
To discourage you from having to work there?
Well, yeah, because everybody wanted to work in the mines. It was the biggest, it was the best money you could possibly make, because it was the most dangerous job. And it would have killed me off real quick because I'm an asthmatic.
Why don't we listen to the song that your book takes its title from, your 1965 hit, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. I've always really loved this record. Where did you get the song from?
I heard Nina Simone sing it.
Really? And, I didn't know she sang this.
Oh, yeah. And I was big fan of Nina. And one night, Linda Eastman suggested that we go see her at Hunter College.
This is Linda Eastman, who became Linda McCartney.
Linda McCartney, sorry. I still think
you know her way back.
Yeah. And I said, oh, come on, Linda, we can't. Yes. And I've got it set up. You're going to meet her backstage. Oh, really? So we, after the show, which blew my mind, completely had me mesmerized, we went backstage, and I was further mesmerized to see that when the autograph hunters had dissipated, that Nina was left sitting there at her dressing table with her manager, who was an ex-Chicago cop, I think, and her guitar player. And she looked up at me and said, so you're the little white that took my song. And I said, yeah, you could say that, And she said, well, thanks for screwing it up or whatever. And I said, listen, if you'll give writer's royalties to the guys in Angola State Prison, who are down there still working under the hot sun in the sugar cane, if you'll give them the acknowledgement for recording a work song that was on one of... Wait a minute, okay. My name's Nina Simone. What's your name? I said, Eric Burton. She said, oh, cool. We shook hands, and we were sort of friends from that point on.
Well, why don't we hear the 1965 recording by Eric Burton and the Animals, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Baby, sometimes I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And sometimes it seems that all I have to do is worry, and then you're bound to see my other side. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood by the Animals. We're listening back to Terry's 2002 interview with the lead singer, Eric Burton. He has a new solo album called My Secret Life. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with the lead singer of the Animals, Eric Burton.
Now, before you started singing rock and roll, you sang jazz. What kind of material were you doing?
Big Joe Turner, Jimmy Witherspoon were my heroes. I listened to a lot of Count Basie. I listened to a lot of, what was called...
Jump blues kind of stuff you were doing?
Well, yeah. That was my love. I mean, that was the stuff that I loved, was jump blues, rhythm and blues. But I also liked cool, West Coast, Shorty Rogers and all that kind of stuff. You know, I couldn't wait to go beyond New York and the Deep South, but also get to the West Coast as well. Because I knew from reading and research that a lot of the players who were a part of the black urban drift who came up from the Mississippi Delta, they moved through Detroit to get jobs, and then if they become successful at recording and they made a little dough and they traveled a lot, they would eventually find themselves out on the West Coast.
When you got to America with the Animals, so much of the music that you loved was from America. Did you meet any of the people who you had idolized when you were living in England?
I met most of them before I left England.
Oh, singing at clubs there?
No, there's a venue in my hometown, the City Hall. It was the only venue available for top-ranking jazz stars and, musicians of every caliber. And I stood in one doorway every night, and in this particular doorway... guaranteed I could meet anybody that I ever wanted to meet. And because of that doorway, I met Louis Armstrong when I was 11 years of age. They took me into his dressing room.
Oh, really? That was nice of him.
His trombone player took me in. Jack Teagarden came out. And they heard that I was singing along with all of the songs. A cop went in there and said, there's this kid out there, man, in the doorway, can't afford to get in. He's singing along with all his songs, And then Jack Teagarden came out towering way above me, I said, come in, I want you to meet Pops. I want to show you something.
It's funny. The Animals started recording in 64. By 67, there was the New Animals. It was a new band that you were playing with. Yeah. And your material had changed, and I imagine your way of performing had changed, and a lot of the culture had changed. By 67, you're talking more hippie culture. You're doing LSD. There's light shows on stage. You're singing San Francisco Nights. it just seems like such a dramatic change in just a couple of years. I'm wondering if you could compare the experience of singing on stage, say, in 1964, at the beginning of that whole British invasion era, with singing in 67.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything changed. The most important thing is that our minds had changed. And that's part of the lyric of one of my songs. Walls move and minds do too, you know. The Animals had arrived in America and did 2 years of touring in America. We'd passed through San Francisco. We'd been to the Hungry Eye to see Lenny Bruce. It was still Bongo Mongo, you know, everybody was wearing black, reading Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And then when I went back, it was like somebody had just taken tons of paint and just plastered the place with graffiti and paisley colors. And even you got off the plane at the airport and everybody had long hair and you could smell incense and marijuana everywhere. Now, what happened here? I mean, this is incredible. So I got a girlfriend who called me. She lived in Sacramento, and she said, "You got to come out and see what's happened to San Francisco. You won't believe it." And I never went back. I thought, this is great. This is the future. We're going to change the world. You know, we're going to really change things.
Well, why don't we hear one of your recordings from that era? You want to hear San Francisco Nights?
Yeah, you can play that, yeah.
Okay, let's hear it.
Strobe lights beam, creates dreams. Walls move, minds do too. On a warm San Franciscan night, old child, young child, feel all right. On a warm San Franciscan night, angels sing, leather wings, jeans of blue, Harley Davidson's too. On a warm San Franciscan night, old angel, young angel, feel all right. On a warm San Francisco night. I wasn't born there, perhaps I'll die there. There's no place left to go. San Francisco.
That's Eric Burdon and the New Animals, recorded in, what, about 67?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 67, yeah.
In the back of your memoir, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, there's a photograph of you. And in this photo, you're rolling a joint and licking it. And on the table is a gun.
Yeah.
What's the gun doing there?
Well, I had to come to America to experience America. And one of the biggest experiences one can have in America is you can own a gun, dude. You have the right to go out there and shoot yourself in the foot. And it's become such a way of life for us that we've forgotten how wicked it really is, you know. But being wicked is part of the thing, you know, that you go out in the world to discover how wicked you can be, how bad you can be, man. I want to be bad, you know. I want to be American. Yeah, I'm in America. What do? I go out and buy a .44 Magnum. In fact, I didn't buy a .44 Magnum. Somebody came to a gig in Wyoming, Billings, Montana, correction. They came to my door with an oily rag, and there was a .44 Magnum in it. And they said, this is a gift from the people of Wyoming. You know, may it protect you. May it serve you well. That gun got me into so much trouble.
What kind of trouble?
I don't want to go into it because
it's
detrimental to my mental health. But I only know that one night I threw it in the swimming pool, and my wife called Jimmy Witherspoon, and Jimmy Witherspoon came up to the house and he said, "What's that piece doing in the pool, man?" And my wife said, "It's Eric's handgun. He doesn't want it anymore." Man, he takes his clothes off, jumps into the pool, retrieves the gun. He had it until the day he died. And I would get messages from him all over the world from people who had met him and run into him. And he would send a message saying, just tell him I got his gun. I got his gun. And it's cool. It's in good condition. It's oiled and it's ready to go.
Did you give up wanting to be bad?
Yeah, after I loosed off a couple of rounds one night trying to get rid of another well-known rock star and realized what damage I could really do, I kind of swore that I'd never touch a weapon again. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't stop me having a fascination for it. I still know every caliber of every gun that's out there. Know thy enemy. Know what you're up against. But I've thrown in the towel on that score.
Eric Burdon. He first came to the U.S. as the lead singer of the British invasion band The Animals. His new CD is called My Secret Life. I'm David B. Cooley. This is Fresh Air.
As I went on walking one fine summer morning, the birds in the bushes did whistle and sing. The lads and the lasses in couples were courting, going back to the factory their work to begin. I spied one among them. She was fairer than most. Her cheeks like a red rose that bloomed.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how to make it big being selfish, neurotic, and annoying. We meet two of the co-conspirators behind HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David and Bob Whitey. And linguist Jeff Nunberg compares the speaking styles of George W. Bush and John Kerry.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. After co-creating and writing the phenomenally popular series Seinfeld, Larry David moved from behind the scenes to star in his own HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which recently completed its fourth season. In the series, Larry David plays an exaggerated version of himself. The chief difference, he says, is that the TV Larry does and says things that the real-life Larry doesn't have the nerve to. And the TV Larry, for saying what he thinks, usually pays for it. Curb's second season is now out on DVD. We'll hear from Larry David in a few minutes, but first, let's listen to Terry's recent interview with Robert Whitey. He's an executive producer and director of Curb. Whitey also has made documentaries about his comic heroes, including Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, and the Marx Brothers, and is working on one now about Kurt Vonnegut. In Curb Your Enthusiasm, many of the plots are based on real-life incidents that actually happened to someone working on the show. Whitey told Terry about one of them.
A few years ago, a friend of mine passed away, and it was all very sad, but the friends got together that night of the funeral, and, you know, my friend lived alone, and he wasn't married, and there was talk about if, you know, his family would eventually be going through his apartment and gathering things, and one of us said, gee, should we go in there first and sort of make a run and see if there's anything that, you know, maybe he wouldn't want his family to discover. And so after a little bit of drinking, we all decided that we should sort of have an understanding that we do that with each other. And if anybody, you know, went prematurely, the others would go into, you know, their home or apartment and start to look to see if there was, you know, any magazines or anything lying about. And so I brought that to Larry, and that wound up being a story in season one, I guess it was, the Porno Gill episode, where Jeff is in the hospital. He's about to have some emergency bypass and asks Larry to go to his house, tells him where the secret stash of pornography is, and asks Larry to gather it up so his wife doesn't find it if, God forbid, something happens on the operating table. But Larry's brilliance, again, was weaving that into a story that he already had about this ex-porno star. And when Larry goes into the house and finds the stash, he finds a tape that, you know, this friend that he just had dinner with appears in and puts it on, and then Jeff's parents walk in. So he can take these ideas and just find a way to fashion them into something way beyond anything you could imagine would ever be that funny.
Well, let's hear a scene from the Porno Gill episode. And this is from Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David Show.
This key right here.
Mysterious.
Very mysterious. This key right here, my front door. I need you to go into my house, okay? Go up to my bedroom, to the left of the TV. There's a cabinet by the bookcase there. Open it up, move the linens. There's linens in there. Move them to the side, push on the back door, and it'll open up. Inside there, I have like my porn collection. I have like 7-8 porn tapes, a couple of magazines, all right? I need you to get them out of there. You gotta get it out of there, because if something happens to me,
oh, right. You're thinking like if the anesthesia, something goes wrong.
Anything goes wrong.
So in case you die, you don't want your wife to discover your porno stuff?
She doesn't understand that. I'm not embarrassed in front of anybody.
I don't really understand it either, but okay, that's okay.
That's your own deal.
Yeah, okay.
That's your own deal, Repression
but,
Jones.
Know, well, what about, is there an alarm code or anything like that?
Easy. 9988.
I better write that down.
In there, it should be a pen and a piece of paper.
9988. Okay.
I can't believe you have to write it down.
What am I going to do with these things?
Keep it in your trunk.
What if I get in an accident on the way home? What about that? And this
porn goes flying everywhere.
Strewn all over the car, and all over my bleeding body.
You'll
this
be
alarm
fine.
Code, I'm worried about this too.
Oh, nothing's going to happen.
I'm no good with stuff like that. It's too technical for me.
9988.
The alarm's going to go off. There'll be a SWAT team descending on me. This whole thing just has disaster written all over it.
It'll be fine, I trust me.
And your wife better not show up.
Yeah, I guarantee she's not gonna be there. She'll be here. I appreciate it. You're a great pal. You're a great pal. I appreciate it.
Try not to die.
Try not to die. Thank you.
How did you start working with Larry David?
Larry and I have known each other for more than 20 years now, and we met initially. I was heading up development for the production management team of Rollins and Joffe, who produce all of Woody Allen's movies and have been with him from the beginning. And, oh, they've managed every great comedian from Robin Williams to Billy Crystal to Robert Klein and Martin Short and on and on. But I was their development person about 20 years ago, a little more, And so one of my duties was to read scripts that came in for non-Woody Allen projects. And a script came on my desk called Prognosis Negative, and I read it, and it was one of the funniest scripts I'd ever read. And I said to the guys, well, we have to bring in this writer, Larry David. This is such a funny script. And we all did know Larry because Larry, at that time, had appeared on a show called Fridays, which was a late-night variety comedy show. So we brought Larry in for these meetings. Now, the story of Prognosis Negative was typical Larry David. It was about a fellow much like Larry. This was, again, you know, years ago, so it would have been the younger Larry, who was single, who was dating and just could never make a commitment to a woman. And he'd go through one relationship after another because he couldn't commit. And then finally he finds out that a woman that he dated a few years ago, who was nice, he quite liked her, finds out that she's terminally ill and that she doesn't know it. That's the beautiful thing. He finds out accidentally from a doctor. And so he thinks, well, this is the perfect relationship because I can go out with her and I can commit to her. And in, what she got, 6 months? In 6 months, it'll be over. So that was sort of the basis of the story. So so Larry would come in for these meetings with myself and the executives there, and the executives would say to Larry, you know, we love the script. It's very, very funny, but boy, this character, you know, he's not very sympathetic. Do you think there's anything you can do to make him a little more sympathetic, a little more likable? And Larry would think about it and then say, no, I don't think so. No, not at all. So it was more important to him to sort of stick to his guns about that character rather than make an easy sale to get the film made and to change it. So I just thought, well, I like this guy. I like his way of thinking. So we started to hang out. I'd go to the clubs with him, the comedy clubs. He was doing stand-up in those days. And so many nights I'd be with him in the clubs and he'd be on stage performing. And some nights he'd do rather well, but there were nights when he would just bomb terribly, and I would just be in the back of the room laughing because I thought the material was brilliant and the audiences did not know what to make of him, and they would just stare up at him like carp in a pond. And I remember thinking, boy, if the country ever caught up to this guy's sense of humor, there'll be chaos in the streets.
What was his stand-up act like?
Well, it was unlike anything else I had seen. First of all, Larry would come out on stage and there was no good evening, how are you, anything like that. He actually looked a little bit like a deer caught in the headlights behind that microphone. And this is one night I remember. This was sort of typical of what he would do. He would come out on stage and the first thing he'd say was, every morning I wake up and thank God that I wasn't born a wealthy Spanish landowner.
Because what?
Which is, you know, a typical opening for a comedy monologue. He say, because if I were, I would never know whether to address the help using the to form or the usted form. He'd say, if I use the usted form, I don't want them to feel I'm being condescending, yet if I use the to form, I don't want them to feel so familiar that they can just come into my kitchen and help themselves to anything in my refrigerator. And that would be the kind of thing that would just knock me on the floor, because to me that was a very sort of Robert Benchley-esque sort of concept, something that harkened back to the days of Benchley and Perlman and those great wits. But the audience was, you know, usually it was 1:30 in the morning and they were sort of drunk and they wanted the, you know, the obvious sex jokes. And I'm telling you, I would be hysterical, but people would be throwing things at him. People would be shouting to him to get off the stage. And Larry has a very combative personality, so he was no shrinking violet. He would start shouting back at the audience. And then there would be the people in the audience who were ready to jump up there and punch him, and then other people who'd be shouting at them to, you know, let him talk. And this melee would break out in the audience for the pro-Larry faction and the anti-Larry faction. And I saw that happen on more than one night.
Robert Whitey is executive producer and one of the directors of Curb Your Enthusiasm. We'll hear more from him and Larry David after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Robert Whitey, executive producer and director of Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Since you've directed so many documentaries about comics, I'm wondering where you think Larry David fits into modern comedy. Because he's kind of like an insult comic, but it's not like he's Don Rickles or something. I mean, he insults... It's more like obnoxious than insulting, though. He insults people all around, but there are people in his real world, since this is a sitcom.
Right. Well, what is interesting is, as schooled as I was in the great comedians, both of the silent era and, you know, the golden age, the 30s, Larry is familiar with very little of that. He's never seen a complete Marx Brothers movie or a W.C. Fields movie, and this is the stuff I grew up on. And Larry and I, a couple of years ago, went to a Harold Lloyd film. It was the first time he had seen Harold Lloyd, maybe the first time he had seen an entire silent feature. And afterwards, we walked out of that theater, and his jaw was agape, and he just said, "My God, that was so funny. I didn't know that silent films were so funny." The only real influences that I've known him to cite have been Abbott and Costello, and really from the TV years more than from their films, and Phil Silvers and Bilko and all of that. But that's what's interesting, is that he is that intuitive. He doesn't give a second thought to really his comic persona in any sort of historical sense. And I'm always thinking about that. And it even informs the way sometimes I'll direct or stage things, or what I'll contribute to stories, whatever. If Larry is doing battle with a little kid, well, that can be uncomfortable unless that little kid has really done something to deserve Larry's wrath. And that was sort of W.C. Fields' thing, is that he could go after Baby Leroy, but only after Baby Leroy dumped Fields' pocket watch into the molasses and was acting like a real brat. And sometimes with Larry and Jeff, I'll stage things in the way that Laurel and Hardy would do it, where if they're facing Jeff's wife, Susie, who's screaming at them, Larry will sort of hide behind Jeff's girth, which is a very kind of Laurel and Hardy move.
This season, Larry David has been cast by Mel Brooks in The Producers, in the role of Max Bialystock, originated by Nathan Lane. How did that plot idea get hatched?
Larry and I were actually in New York a few years ago, I think, doing some publicity for maybe it was the second season or the third season, and we saw The Producers in New York, not with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, but another cast that was in. And Larry, just watching these people on stage singing and dancing, just was flabbergasted. How did they do that? How do they memorize all that? How do they know all the steps? And he just thought it was the scariest notion in the world. And then he started to think, geez, what if I were put in that situation where I had to do all that? And again, that was just an idea that grew out of that moment of seeing the show. And the season finale this year is the opening night of The Producers on Broadway. And audiences can see if disaster strikes or not when Larry takes to the boards.
Well, Robert Whitey, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Bob Whitey, speaking earlier this year with Terry Gross. Since that interview, Curb viewers have seen Larry open in The Producers and learned in the season finale twist ending that Mel Brooks and his wife Anne Bancroft had their own reasons for casting Larry in their hit Broadway musical.
Did you see the look on their faces when Larry David forgot every line he had? He went up in smoke.
Oh, God, I'm so glad. I'm so thankful. Thank God that this damn play is going to be over. We're going to get our lives back.
He has freed us from the anchor, from the albatross of The Producers, which has invaded our lives every single minute, every hour of every day.
Trapping us.
No more openings in Cleveland. No more sleeping in dirty beds in Pittsburgh. We're free. Free at last.
I know.
Isn't it wonderful?
How did you know that he could ruin the show? How?
The minute I laid eyes on him, I said, this guy's a disaster. He's a living disaster. He's a storm. He's like a storm that will destroy everything in its path. I mean, he's got this gift. Everything he touches, he dooms. He's a little cyclone, a little tornado destroying the St. James Theater.
I know.
Any minute now, the show will be dead. Here, a toast to the death of The Producers. May it rest in peace.
As disasters go, Larry David is amazingly successful on stage in that season finale and in real life. It's an amazing success, in part, because of some of the things his character does on Curb. Last season, he plotted to commit adultery, insulted a Holocaust survivor, and stole cake from a blind man. Curb Your Enthusiasm takes to extremes a principle Larry David followed with Seinfeld, which he co-created. You can base a sitcom around self-absorbed and inconsiderate characters. Terry spoke with Larry David in 1992.
Now, you used to do stand-up.
Yes, that's true.
When did you start doing it, and what was your act like?
I started doing it in 1975, and it's hard to describe what my act was like, because very often I would leave in the middle of it. As soon as I saw somebody in the audience just make a face or somebody talk to the person next to them, I would become infuriated and throw the microphone down and leave.
That was it? You just not
and
come
I would,
back?
I would get in fights with the audience if they weren't laughing. I was like the McEnroe of comedy. I couldn't stand adversity. Yeah, but that's pretty much what would happen. I would be in the middle of a show and I would just walk off.
So with a reputation like that, who would hire you?
Nobody. And see, no one. No one would hire me. But I did, I was able to perform at the showcase clubs. Because they liked me. They didn't care if I walked off.
They probably weren't paying you anyways, right?
That's exactly the point. Right. Yeah, they weren't.
Why would you walk off? Why were you so easily discouraged when somebody wouldn't laugh or would heckle?
Because I'm a baby. I'm a big baby, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand like losing. It was like winning and losing. And if I lost to the audience, I couldn't take it. I would throw the board over.
Well, did you ever kill on stage?
Oh yes. Yeah, I did. Yeah, very, very often, in fact.
And you'd complete those sets?
Those I would complete, yeah. And that was always an exhilarating feeling for me.
You were with Saturday Night Live for 84 to 85, is that right?
Yes, yes, one season.
What were some of the sketches you wrote?
They only put on the air one sketch of mine the entire season.
Which one?
No one in the world wouldn't know what it was, except maybe a few people in my family. The sketch was on, it was the last sketch of a show that Ed Begley Jr. was the host of. And the sketch was on at 5 to 1 in the morning. And Ed Begley Jr. played an architect, and Harry Shearer was the developer. And Harry Shearer was looking over the plans for the new building that Ed Begley had designed. And he saw, he was looking over the blueprint, and he said to Ed Begley, what's this thing over here? And Ed Begley said, oh, that's the elevator. And then Harry Shearer said, no, but what's this? And he said, oh, that's a stool for the elevator man to sit. And then Harry Shearer said that a stool? He didn't want his elevator men sitting on stools. And they just got in a fight, and that was the sketch. It's pretty stupid.
I don't remember it.
No, I'm sure you don't.
Yeah. How is it that you worked there for a whole year or a whole season and only got one sketch on?
Because Dick Ebersole didn't like my material. He was the executive producer. Dick and I didn't quite get along. Dick and I had a few problems.
Did you feel like, what's the point of staying if your material isn't going to get on?
Yes, yes. In fact, I actually quit the show, and there's a Seinfeld episode that's based on this. One day I walked into Ebersole's office. It was like right before one of the shows was about to start. He had cut one of my sketches after dress rehearsal. And I walked up to him right before airtime, 10 minutes before airtime, and I walked up to myself. That's it. I'm finished. I quit. I've had it. I'm never coming back here again. It's over, done. I hate this place. I quit. So I left. I left the building, and I started walking home, and I felt very good. I quit the show. I wasn't going to put up with that. And I got home, and I started thinking about my salary and how much money I was giving up. And I go, let's see, that's 3,000 there, that's 15, 20, that's $40,000. What am I out of my mind? I'm going to give this guy $40,000. It's another couple of weeks. What am I, crazy? You know? So on Monday morning, I went back in and pretended that the whole thing never happened. And I went into the meeting. I said good morning to everybody. people gave me some strange looks, and Ebersole never said another word to me about it, so I just continued working there. But I wrote an episode for Seinfeld about it last year when George quit his job.
Larry David, thanks a lot for talking with us. And if I ever get the chance to see you perform live, I'll be sure to laugh.
Yeah, either that or bring your earplugs or a bulletproof vest or something. Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Larry David, speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. The second season of Curb Your Enthusiasm is out now on DVD. Coming up, linguist Jeff Numberg listens to the words of John Kerry and George W. Bush. This is Fresh Air. Is John Kerry nuanced, or is he equivocal? Is that forthrightness we're hearing from George Bush, or is it arrogance? Jeff Nunberg has been listening to both men with a linguist's ear, and he thinks those impressions may depend on how they use little words like now and see.
Which of the major presidential candidates recently began a section of a foreign policy speech with a phrase, as complicated as Iraq seems? You needn't have heard this speech to guess that it was John Kerry. George Bush doesn't begin a lot of sentences by reminding you that the issue is complicated. It's hard to think of two presidential candidates who deal with complexity more differently than those two do. The one acknowledging it at every turn, the other gliding over it as if it weren't there. If you're looking for a stylistic key to Kerry's complexity complex, listen to the sentences he begins with now. I'm not talking about the now that means at this moment, but the now that announces a reservation or concession, the one that sets up a but somewhere down the line. As in, now I know it's no beauty, but it'll get you to work on time. That's where Kerry piles on his qualifications and hedges before he finally comes down on a question. Here he is in a recent interview with the Washington Post.
The way to go is to try to maximize the ability to be successful. Now, this administration may have, and I say may have, I don't know the answer to this. They also may not have. It may be that we get Brahimi through a successful process. It may be there's a sufficient level of deal cut. It may be that the parties will all quell their individual aspirations long enough to get us out of there and reduce the level and then go at it. I don't know. I mean, you don't know either. None of us do. But I'll tell you, we're not maximizing the potential for the outcome that we went in there to achieve.
That's a typical Kerry comment with as many forks and switchbacks as the Boston subway. The style makes him an easy mark for charges that he's inconsistent or lacks strong convictions, particularly if you pull out a snippet to use as a soundbite. They may have, they may also not have. But Kerry's involuted syntax is less a sign of prevarication than of an excess of prudence. He steps into a thought like someone cautiously wading into a rocky stream, always probing with his toe for stones. And when he finally does set his foot down, it's cushioned in abstractions. We're not maximizing the potential for the outcome we went in there to achieve. When he's finished, it's sometimes hard to tell if he's actually touched bottom. George Bush rarely allows complexities to cloud his remarks. Even if he wanted to, his syntax wouldn't be up to it. In fact, he often conveys a puzzlement that things aren't as clear to others as they are to him. You can hear that attitude in his predilection for beginning sentences with see or you see, which he'll sometimes do half a dozen times in a single press conference. Ordinarily, you use those expressions when you're letting your listeners in on a hidden explanation,
something you know that they don't. See, that's why they wrap them that way, so you can't tell they've shrunk the package. But the remarks that Bush begins with C are rarely things that would come as news to the audience. They're more often platitudes or truisms.
It's an opportunity for us to say to a mother or a dad, here's your chance to achieve your expectation for your child. You see, a society that is responsible is one in which a mother and dad, you know, love their children with all their heart and all their soul. And that's the definition of full sovereignty. You see, when a government's fully sovereign, they then make requests on the behalf of their people. This economy of ours is strengthening, and that's positive. See, we want people working here in America. We don't even want people working. Freedom-loving people did not seek this conflict. It has come to us by the choices of violent men, hateful men. See, we seek peace.
It isn't likely that Bush thought that any of those remarks he introduced with C were revelations to his audience. But then, that isn't really what he's doing with the word. It's like beginning a sentence with, let me tell you a little secret, or this may come as news to you. It's a way of packaging a truism as if it were inside information, with the implication that there are some people who may not find it as obvious as it is to you and me. It's as if to say that the world is really a simple place, except to the people who make things too complicated to see the truth in front of their noses. See, I believe you have to ask for the vote. See, terrorists hate freedom. To Bush's supporters, that little habit may convey resolute self-confidence. But others are apt to hear it as smug and simplistic, the same way that Kerry's elaborate verbal hedging can make him sound overcomplicated and equivocal. That may seem a lot to lay on the back of a few conversational tics, but then sometimes the prefatory noises we make unconsciously can be more revealing than the words that follow them. The style is the man himself, said the Count de Buffon in the 18th century. People sometimes quote that dictum as if it meant that a man was no more than his style. But Buffon wasn't being reductive. He only meant that there's no choice we make that doesn't open a little window onto our nature.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the 50th anniversary of the Newport Jazz Festival, where Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, and many others performed. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from George Ween, the founder of the annual Rhode Island event. Join us for the next Fresh Air.